Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with James Gaffigan. The young American conductor with a growing reputation at home and abroad conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra this evening. David Patrick Stearns profiles composer Mizzy Mazzoli. The in-demand Lansdale native has upcoming commissions from major orchestras and has just premiered her first multimedia chamber opera. Susan Lewis considers Pennsylvania Ballet's production of The Messiah. And we visit the Rosenbach Museum and Library for the story of a 19th century married couple reunited in 2012 in art. That's all I have this morning on Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The career of conductor James Gaffigan is on the rise. This season, the New York-born 32-year-old took up two significant posts in Europe as chief conductor of the Lucerne Symphony Orchestra and principal guest conductor of the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic Orchestra. He also returns to guest conduct the Minnesota Orchestra and the National, Toronto, Dallas, Baltimore and Milwaukee Symphonies. He makes debuts at the Spoleto Festival and with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, the Atlanta Symphony and the Philadelphia Orchestra. In his mid-20s, while an assistant conductor at the Cleveland Orchestra working under Franz Welser-Most, Gaffigan took first prize in the 2004 Sir George Schulte International Conducting Competition, springboarding his career and taking him onto the podiums of many of the world's top orchestras, including the Chicago, St. Louis and Detroit Symphonies, the London Philharmonic, the Dresden Staatskapelle, the Sydney Symphony and the Vienna Philharmonic. I met with James Gaffigan earlier this week, backstage at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall. There's a really interesting entry on your website in one of your blogs where your manager calls you when you're in the Czech Republic in Prague and says, oh, Jimmy from Staten Island is conducting the Czech Philharmonic. But it has to be said there have been a lot of Jimmy from Staten Island moments over the last couple of years. That's not to say that this has been overnight. This success has been gradual in coming, right?
Yeah, it has been. But I've been very lucky to have some key players in my life, whether it be my management or other conductors like David Zinman or Franz Welser-Most, to really take care that I do things properly and not rush anything. So I think if people care about you, they'll take good care of you. And in this business, you need mentors and you need a team of people around you to really to help you through all of this. So I've been very fortunate to have good people around me since I was 19 and started.
Zinman is a very good case in point, an American conductor in a major Swiss orchestra, and you're in the same situation. What's been the advice he's given you? What did he say to you on your first meeting? What did he say when you found out you were going to go and be in Lucerne as music director?
Well, I think when I knew Mr. Zinman most closely was basically during our Aspen years, the 3 years I spent at Aspen Music Academy, this kind of academy for conductors that he started. And he told all of us, actually, from the beginning, if I were to give you any advice at the beginning of your careers, always rent, never buy, and find yourself a good wife. And that was really funny to me, but it meant more things than just that. He has a way of teaching young conductors how to do things in private so you're not doing them in front of a major symphony orchestra. He always made it clear to, if you're going to do a Bruckner symphony for the first time, do it with an orchestra that's not in the spotlight. And also with concerti, you should never be accompanying the Elgar Violin Concerto for the first time with the Philadelphia Orchestra. You know, there are these danger, these pitfalls that young conductors need to know. Even if you study the Rite of Spring since the age of 13 and have it memorized and can write it out, you still shouldn't be conducting it with the New York Philharmonic for the first time. So it's these little things that seem
obvious. Why? Because they're going to play it their own way and that's it.
Well, that's one of the things that they have their tradition. And with a piece like Rite of Spring or Beethoven Symphony No. 5, these orchestras have their way of doing it. And even if they love you and try and they want to do what you're asking for, it's still going to be a little bit of a, not a battle, but difficult. But the reason I was talking about before is that sonically, you're not ready to hear what these pieces sound like. My one word of advice to my colleagues or people younger than me is just do it for the first time, whether it means with a youth orchestra or a lesser-known orchestra, because just hearing those sounds for the first time is quite overwhelming. I remember experience for me with Webern Passacaglia. You know, you study this piece. I wrote a paper about it in school. I knew it so well, but when it was all happening, I studied it so much that it was like overload for my brain. And Esa-Pekka Salonen told me once when I was young, he said, you need to step back. you know, in these situations as a conductor. You need to hear the bigger picture. If you start micromanaging, the orchestra's going to hate you. You're going to lose your mind up there because it's never going to be as perfect as you want it to be. So that was a really good advice, and that goes for especially all impressionistic music, all this Debussy, L'Après-Midi or La Mer. If you get so hung up on the details, you'll really forget the big picture.
This was a lesson that was brought home to you as well with the Vienna Philharmonic, I believe, that you were trying to, I think by your own admission, overconduct them. And every time you tried to overconduct them, it didn't go well. When you let them be the Vienna Philharmonic and provide them as much information as they needed to stay together, it worked better, right?
Well, the way it really happened was Franz Felsenmoos, the music director of the State Opera, came to my dressing room minutes before I went in the pit for the first time with the Vienna Philharmonic. And he said, James, you're going to be great. You know this music inside and out, but I'm giving you some friendly advice. You're going to want to be clear. You're going to want to be as clear as you possibly can, but don't. He said, show them the direction in which way to go. Show them colors that you want them to make. Show them that you're there with the singer, breathing with the singer. They'll do everything else. He goes, as soon as you start trying to keep them together, you're going to fail. And it was the best advice ever for that orchestra. If you start subdividing and becoming controlling, they just shut down somehow. They actually go slower, they play with less energy. And I did it a couple of times. I was guilty of it, of a couple crucial moments that I know in Bohème that have worked for me in the past in Zurich Opera, for example. When I tried to really be clear and really nail these transitions, they kind of just look at me and say, what are you doing? You know, let us do that. You know, we're smart enough to figure out where these little pizzicati go.
And so familiar with the work that they hadn't even rehearsed it for 25 years when you went in there,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah, the last time they did a rehearsal on La Bohème was with Carlos Kleiber in 1985, I believe it was. I mean, that was mind-blowing. That's another piece of information that Franz told me in the dressing room, and I couldn't believe it. But this orchestra, look, everything wasn't perfect. I'm not going to say it was. I'm not going to lie. But my God, was it amazing. And it just showed that the more an orchestra listens, the more magic happens and the less I need to be controlling in any way. Because it's not a conductor's job to be controlling. It's a conductor's job to let the orchestra play as best they can. As soon as you start controlling, you mess up. You get in people's way. You mess up the flow. And you shouldn't be a conductor. If you're a control freak, you shouldn't be a conductor.
Wow.
No, I'm serious. If you need to know every single thing that's going to happen, you know, why not go into something with numbers? Why not be an accountant
or a pianist?
No, come on. No. You know what I mean. I just think the most incredible things happen in concerts when you let go.
James Gaffigan. In a program that features works by Bernstein, Gershwin, and Tchaikovsky, he conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra this evening at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall at 8.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Electric guitars, singers without words. It's not your typical opera overture, but that's what greeted audiences walking into the Manhattan New Music venue, The Kitchen, for a new opera titled Song from the Uproar. Maybe you haven't heard of the composer Mizzy Mazzoli, but you will over the next year if you're near Carnegie Hall, the Albany or Detroit Symphonies, or the Kronos Quartet. Though she's from the small town environs of Lansdale, PA, the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns had to track her down in Brooklyn, where she's the best known of a young, cutting-edge school of composers who write for symphony orchestras as well as for indie rock bands, as if it's the most natural thing in the world.
The more you hear of Mizzy Mazzoli, the less likely you are to miss what's happening in the next generation of music. While composers such as Steve Mackey and Scott Johnson pioneered classical music composed for and by non-classical instruments, such as electric guitar, 31-year-old Mazzoli has equal opportunity taste and sound. She grew up in Lansdale, playing Beethoven on piano and listening to the 90s rock band Pearl Jam. She now heads an indie rock group named Victoire. But in her opera, Song from the Uproar, she also incorporated an antique gramophone crackle that sets the scene for her story of Swiss adventurer Isabel Eberhardt, who masqueraded as a man as she traveled through the deserts of North Africa and died amid a natural disaster in 1904. But how does electric guitar fit into that?
in the opera, the guitar really drives so much of the music, because it's this very intense, vivid story, and the guitar has such a range of colors and sort of has the intensity that the story needs to carry it forward.
But surely, her compositional process for opera and her band Victoire must be dissimilar.
Well, I mean, it doesn't really change it that much. I feel like every sort of medium is inspiring in very different ways. For example, I love the huge sound you can get from an orchestra. I love the colors, but I also love the intimacy of a chamber ensemble because each instrument sort of becomes a character. So it just works dramatically really well.
What often comes out is music written with distinctive layers, sort of a club sandwich with extreme ingredients and never the same ingredients. For her yet untitled Albany Symphony Commission that will be premiered in May, she's incorporating a lot of chorales, the hymn-like music that figures so heavily in the works of J.S. Bach.
My idea was to write music for a religion that doesn't exist, because I wasn't raised religiously, but so much of music comes out of the church. I was actually inspired by my neighbor, who is an artist and who has sort of built his own temple on his property. And looking at the work of what have traditionally been called outsider artists, that was really attractive to me. So the idea of like finding spirituality and dedicating yourself to this sort of huge task, but outside of the confines of organized religion.
Secular religiosity. One point of reference for that is Alban Berg's great 1935 violin concerto, which also incorporates chorales, at least under the surface.
That piece was a huge influence on me when I was a kid. Actually, that was one of the first pieces of 20th century music that I encountered. So maybe there's a little bit of that in this piece.
But where, one wonders, does one find recordings and scores of the Berg Violin Concerto in Lansdale, an aging industrial town whose main claim to fame is having been the setting for the sci-fi TV show Fringe? Though the borough of 17,000 people, 28 miles outside of Philadelphia, had the Lansdale Center for the Performing Arts in 2009, it lasted only a little over a year. Yet, at age 10, Mazzoli knew she wanted to be a composer, and her parents, both of whom are special education teachers, supported her.
I'd never stopped believing in myself. I always knew that this is what I was going to do. Even if I wasn't successful at it, this is something I have to do. So that was actually a tremendous relief to just feel like I need to do this no matter what happens.
What she missed was a female role model. Julia Wolfe and Jennifer Higdon were then making names for themselves but weren't as well known as they are now. Nonetheless, Mazzoli went off to Tanglewood's summer study program at age 17, discovered the Berg Violin Concerto, and went on to study at Yale, Boston University, and the Royal Conservatory of The Hague, where she worked with the great Dutch minimalist Louis Andriessen. Such credentials, however, don't make composing easy, as she said in an interview on violinist Hilary Hahn's YouTube channel.
Thank God it's getting easier. I mean, I used to just be tortured and tortured and tortured. Every piece was like reinventing the wheel. Mm-hmm. And it still is, which I think is actually very important, that I still feel like I'm starting something completely different every time I write a piece. But I do, I think I've gotten into better habits lately of writing that make my life a lot easier. You know, I mean, I write at the same time every day. I wake up and I write, and it's the first thing that I do. Even if I just do it for 10 minutes.
Right.
And that was very important because I think that just psychologically, it's so easy just to like do the dishes and then answer email and do all these other things, you know?
Yeah, I know.
And then that becomes, if you're doing that first, it's almost like you're saying that that's the most important thing in my life.
While living in Boston, Mazzoli stumbled upon the memoirs of Isabel Eberhardt, writings that had somehow survived the flash flood that killed her. It was a big life and one that Mazzoli needed to make into an opera. Now, Song from the Uproar is the first in a projected trilogy of operas about remarkable women. But it's not the events of these lives that makes good opera, at least in the case of Eberhardt.
I mean, what really drew me to her story was sort of the things between the lines, the things that she didn't say. And there was tremendous freedom and tremendous space to imagine how she felt when she was going through all this stuff. So how does it feel to be alone in the desert dressed as a man?
Already, the opera is in the recording studio, Mazzoli having raised half the money for the project. It's fair to say that her community is pulling for her.
Brooklyn right now is an incredible place to be. I mean, you can't go to the grocery store without, like, running into a composer. It's this really intense community of friends, and that is what sort of drives all these sort of collaborative projects.
This is how the world changes. A composer imagines sounds that have no place among established ensembles. So one must be created by the composer. In Mazzoli's case, her so-called rock band is really more in the tradition of the Philip Glass Ensemble. And from there, she branches out. One promising sign is that the music world is struggling to label her. She's been dubbed the post-millennial Mozart of Brooklyn. That sounds flattering, though nobody, including her, is sure what it means. Indie classical is another, and she's more comfortable with that, if only because she couldn't be more indie. But that's too vague. So the world is just going to have to figure out this labelless composer one piece at a time.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Although American audiences are more accustomed to hearing Handel's Messiah during the Christmas season, the oratorio was originally composed for a concert at this time of year. And while Messiah is usually a listening experience, a production now at Pennsylvania Ballet, first performed by the company 4 years ago, adds visuals with costumes, sets, and, of course, dancers. Handel himself may have never set this music to dance, but as WRTI's Susan Lewis explains, this ballet is in many ways in keeping with the spirit of the 18th century composer.
The first performance of Messiah was on April 13, 1742, on Fishamble Street in Dublin. German-born George Frederick Handel was by then a successful opera composer living in England. Two reasons compelled him to write Messiah as an oratorio, a dramatic choral work performed with orchestra based on biblical text. English tastes for opera were waning, and he was commissioned to create a concert during the Christian observance of Lent, when theatrical performances, like opera, were banned. Fast forward some 250-plus years to 1999. Former artistic director of Pennsylvania Ballet, choreographer Robert Weiss, was putting together the first Christmas season of his new company, the Carolina Ballet, in Raleigh, North Carolina. Weiss seized the moment to create Messiah as a ballet for at least two reasons of his own. The Nutcracker, the perennial favorite, had already been scheduled by another company. And the music of Messiah had captivated Weiss since he'd first heard it at a concert as a young boy and wanted to dance in the aisle.
And the music always struck me as something that could, you could tell the story and you could also dance to it, and the joyous parts would just be so bouncy and joyous, and the sad, angst-ridden parts. I mean, it's very theatrical, even though it's an oratorio.
He was famous in his operatic work for being able to create the psychology of a character musically.
David Hayes is music director of the Philadelphia Singers, who are performing Messiah with Pennsylvania Ballet this week. The composer, says Hayes, drew on his own vast repertoire.
I think the most fascinating aspect of it is, you know, some of the most famous choruses, for instance, For Unto Us a Child Is Born, actually did not begin life in that piece. That is a duet that he wrote many years earlier to an Italian text talking about the beauties of spring and love, etc., and somehow he transformed that into For Unto Us a Child Is Born.
The oratorio does tell a story. Although Handel's librettist, Charles Jennens, fashioned it not from an intact biblical text, as was typical, but from assorted biblical references from various books of the Bible.
Jennens created a pretty masterful libretto, actually, when you think about it, from all the disparate places that he took sentences or fragments of text. And Handel's response to it was pretty amazing in the sense that he sort of blisteringly wrote this piece. I mean, we know that from the dates on the manuscript that he essentially wrote it over the course of about three-ish weeks in a kind of a fevered pitch of creative fury, if you will.
In some places, Handel engages in text painting, his music mimicking the meaning of the words.
Pictorial elements in the music are sometimes referred to as madrigalisms. And Handel was obviously coming out of that tradition, and We Like Sheep Have Gone Astray is a very good example of that. So you can sort of hear the musical line wandering around, sort of underscoring the idea of people going astray.
Descriptive sacred text and commanding music. When Robert Weiss first suggested adding dance, he faced some resistance.
Number one, it's too holy a piece. You're going to do something that's going to offend somebody. The music is so complete. What are you going to add to it? You're only going to take something away from it by having a visual. And I said, you know, look, maybe it will fail, but I want to try. I said, this is just something I've always wanted to do, and I'm going to do it, and we'll see what happens.
What happened? The work was a great success. The dancers act out a tale within a tale, the story of the Messiah within the story of a congregation celebrating the Messiah. In part one, the cavernous dark space of a church is suggested. Shafts of light shine on assembled worshipers. Part two goes back to biblical times, with costumed dancers telling the story of the Passion. And part three, the aftermath, is a ballet in white, symbolizing purity, harmony, and balance. Some sections are literal. A dancer cradles a newborn infant, a dancing angel is adorned with large golden wings, and soldiers spar with sticks and flags. Other parts are more abstract. The order of music, for the most part, follows the oratorio. In one notable exception, Weiss moved the Hallelujah chorus to the end of part one.
Hallelujah, hallelujah.
And no, it's not expected that the audience should stand, as has been traditional with the oratorio ever since King George reportedly stood up during that movement in 1743. In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania Ballet artistic director Roy Kaiser was originally drawn to Weiss's Messiah because of the way the dance and the music enrich one another.
I always loved the score, but what I took away from it for the most part was just the emotion and the power in certain segments, and that's what I think Ricky caught with the choreography.
Weiss's dance, he says, propels the story and provides a striking visual dimension to the powerful and familiar music.
I think it just adds another layer to what you already know of the score. And I think possibly in certain parts of the piece, maybe you'll discover something new about the score through the movement.
While much of the ballet is on point, there is a pas de deux danced barefoot. Weiss resists classifying his choreography as strictly one style or another. He starts with the classical idiom and then incorporates everything he knows. He says ballet is the great gobbler of all other dance forms.
Ballet actually takes everything and makes it more classical and incorporates it in some way.
While the dancers learn the movements, the singers learn the text and music. Singing as part of a ballet involves the same kind of skills involved in opera productions, says Philadelphia Singers music director David Hayes.
Like any staged production, there has to be a certain amount of flexibility to what's going on the stage.
And so a 21st century ballet continues to expand Handel's masterpiece, joining graceful movement to its glorious music and colorful text, providing a chance to contemplate what Robert Weiss hopes is a universal message.
You don't need to have any religion to feel a sense of spirituality and connectedness to everyone else in the world. We're all striving to be better than we necessarily are. And I think that's what the piece is about.
Robert Weiss ending that report by WRTI's Susan Lewis. Pennsylvania Ballet performs Weiss's Messiah with performances today and tomorrow at 2 and next Saturday at 2 and 8. Our next item takes us out of the studio and to the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Center City, Philadelphia. And with us is Judith Gustin, who is the curator and director of collections. We're here because there's a wonderful, wonderful romantic story of a woman, a young woman called Mariah, who was recently reunited with her husband, many, many years after they both died.
Exactly, exactly. Mariah Gratz, the first wife of Benjamin Gratz. Benjamin's portrait's been with us for a long time. He came here in 1970, and Mariah just arrived here at the end of last year and has just been installed in our parlor in early February.
And these are portraits by the very well-known late 19th century Philadelphia, well, British, but then Philadelphia portraitist Thomas Sully. So the Gratz, they weren't native to Philadelphia. They had these portraits done by Sully when they were here visiting family, right?
Exactly. Benjamin was actually born here in Philadelphia. He was the youngest son of Michael Gratz, who was an early Jewish immigrant to Philadelphia, came here in 1759. And he had 12 children, 10 of whom survived to adulthood. And Benjamin was their baby. He grew up and moved to Kentucky, mostly because of his wife, Mariah, who was a native of Kentucky. He and his wife, Mariah, were visiting their sister, Rebecca Gratz, probably their most famous sibling. And they were visiting her in December 1830 and saw a picture that Thomas Sully was painting of her, which we also have here in our parlor, and thought it was a good idea that they have a portrait of her painted to take home with them to Kentucky. And then the three of them thought it would be a great idea if she had portraits of them, Benjamin and Mariah, painted to stay here in Philadelphia with her. So all of these portraits were painted at the same time.
So the portrait of Benjamin comes back to Philadelphia and indeed is bequeathed to the Rosenbach in 1970. But Mariah is missing. Nobody knows where she is. Tell me the story of how we find out how Mariah is and then the conversation that takes place about the idea of this very, very handsome couple being reunited together.
Right. We had two bequests, the one in 1970, which brought us Benjamin, and that other portrait of Rebecca Gratz as well. And then there was another bequest in 1984 from the descendants of Mariah Gratz herself. And at that time, they said to us, we know that there's this portrait of Mariah by Thomas Sully, but we just don't know where it went. It must have left the family, or maybe it went someplace else. We just don't know. But we do have this black and white photograph of what they called a crayon copy, which meant a pastel, of the portrait itself. And they left that in the file for us. When I got here to the Rosenbach in 1999, I saw that in the file and I thought, gee, you know, someday we'll look for that portrait. And in 2010, when we brought in the wonderful portrait of Rebecca Gratz that was the instigator for the production of all of these portraits, I said, maybe it's time to start looking for that little portrait of Mariah Gratz and bring all of these portraits together. We have a docent, one of our tour guides here, who writes a wonderful blog online about Rebecca Gratz in the 19th century. And I went to Susan Sklaroff, our docent, and said, do you think we could post this black and white photo that we have in our file and see maybe there's someone out there who's following your blog who knows where these portraits are, the pastel and the oil portrait? And she said, sure, let's do that. And so we posted it on the blog, and Susan wrote, you know, this portrait is missing. Do you know where it is? Kind of like a search you do on a milk carton. Do you know this woman? And it wasn't about 3 weeks when I got a message on my answering machine here at the Rosenbach saying, my name is Mariah Gratz, of all things.
Ah!
Mariah Gratz Roberts from Atlanta, Georgia, and I think I'm the person you're looking for. At which point I was, you know, I could feel my heart just beating and pounding in my chest. And I called her back, and I said, you know, tell me about the portrait you have. And she did, and I went down to visit her in Atlanta, and there in her parlor was the portrait we were looking for.
Of her great-great-great-grandmother.
Of her great-great-great-grandmother, Mariah Gratz, and it was by Thomas Sully, unmistakable. And there it was, and she said, would you like it?
Just like that. There was no, how do I approach this delicately? We'd like to...
You know, usually you kind of feel you need to do that. As a curator, I've had those kinds of conversations with potential donors. But this woman was so nice and presented herself as a donor right away. And she said, I think you need this portrait. She needs to be reunited with her husband. She needs to be in Philadelphia. And this is the right thing to do.
Curator and director of collections at the Rosenbach Museum and Library, Judith Gustin. Thomas Sully's portraits of Benjamin and Mariah Gratz are now on view at the Rosenbach. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony in C under music director Russin Milnov. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.